Our first paper this afternoon is from John Maranburn of Trinity College, Cambridge, and he's going to speak on a subject about which he's written quite extensively and has more, I believe, to say, pagans and philosophers. John.
Thank you very much indeed. I've called it pagans and philosophers in the wide 12th century, and I think you'll see why I say wide. The book which, beyond all others, has affected my approach to medieval philosophy is one of the many by this conference's organizer, Alain de Libera. Not his most well-known or even his most challenging publication, but something rather more like a textbook. That's to say, the book called simply La Philosophie Médiévale, first published nearly 25 years ago. Its central idea, at once obvious and unheard of, that studying medieval philosophy means learning about the Latin, Greek, Arabic, and Hebrew traditions, changed the way I organized my teaching, wrote general books, and even how I go about my more specialized research. It is therefore a special pleasure and honor to have been asked by Anna to speak at a conference which has been shaped by this conception, since participants are invited to think about 12th century philosophizing in terms of the confrontation and symbiosis between Greeks, Latins, Jews, and Arabs. The approach to the different traditions in Anna's book, in La Philosophie Médiévale, is a modular one. The book brings them all together, but it presents them in separate chapters, and indeed even divides Eastern and Western Islam. This conference, similarly, follows, for the most part, a modular approach. There are separate papers about Muslim thinkers, about Jewish thinkers, and about those writing in Latin, including discussion of direct Arabic influence, and indeed that of the Greeks, but nothing which attempts a comparison. That's to say, nothing until now. For while gratefully borrowing Alain's model of the four traditions, I've always preferred to depart from it in one respect, moving away from modularity and juxtaposing the different traditions or sub-traditions as they developed over time. And so, too, this afternoon, I shall try to look comparatively at one theme across the different sub-traditions, hence my idea of the wide 12th century. But you might say, am I not allowing myself to be misled by the mere fact of simultaneity? The philosophy of 12th century Latin Europe, my critic might say, was not just separate from that done by Muslims and Jews in Arabic, but a world apart. As the blurb for our conference puts it, the century was one of transition for Latin philosophy, but a golden age for the Arabic Muslim world. Isn't the real comparison, therefore, between 12th century Arabic and 13th century Latin philosophy, which shared its access to almost all Aristotle and was deeply influenced by it? But there are arguments you can make against this. Many of you will know the famous article by Dimitri Gutas, where he identifies the whole period from 1000 through to 1350 as the golden age of Arabic philosophy. Whilst I, for one, would be willing to hold up the 12th century philosophy of Latin Europe as no less golden than that of the 13th. Of course, these labels don't mean very much in any case, but I'm very anxious to avoid the relay race model of how Islamic and Jewish thought is incorporated into the history of medieval philosophy. According to this model, the baton of ancient Greek thought was passed to the late ancient schools, then to the philosophers, Muslims, and Jews writing in Arabic, and in turn, and with embellishments, to the Latin world in the 13th century. Up until 1200, the Latins stood idly by, and after that date, the Muslims and Jews stayed on the sidelines. I prefer us to envisage the Arabic and Latin thinkers as two branches of a tradition unified through the similar body of ancient source material available immediately or potentially to both, but drawn on and exploited differently. From this perspective, comparisons are especially interesting where there is no or very limited direct influence. One such area of comparison, which I've tried to tackle elsewhere, is logic. Another is 12th century philosophy, for precisely the reasons just set out by my critic. As a theme for such a comparison, I'm taking an idea I've worked on quite a bit in the Latin tradition, what I call the problem of paganism. How can the virtue and wisdom of many pagans be reconciled with their ignorance of the true religion and the fact that, according to an obvious reading of Christian doctrine, they are damned? Here, I'm leaving aside the moral and theological aspects of the problem to concentrate on the pagan philosophers and the challenge posed by their wisdom in the three religious traditions, Latin, Christian, and Arabic, Muslim, and Jewish. I shall explore two topics in particular. The first one is what I'll call philosophy from nowhere, and the second, interpreting the truth and concealing it. So to begin, philosophy from nowhere. And I'm going to start with a work that you've already heard quite a lot about this morning. And I may be repeating one or two things you would have been told, but that will just help perhaps to remind you. The work is Peter Abelard's Collationes, or his dialogue between a philosopher, a Jew, and a Christian. So two of the three dream characters there, so of the philosopher, the Jew, and the Christian, reason on the basis of a firm position, which they develop with a dexterity characteristic of their author, Abelard. For the Jew, this firm position is the old law, and for the Christian, the old law as superseded by the new law. But the central feature of the philosopher's position, as you've heard already, is precisely that he follows no revealed law but reason alone. As such, he's like one of the philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome, whom Abelard had eulogized in his Theologia Christiana. But there is an important difference. There, Abelard's concern was directed towards Plato and the Platonists, inhabitants, he believed, of real-life Platonic republics. Although these philosophers lived before the coming of Christ, he doesn't present them as doing their thinking entirely apart from revelation. Although they could understand something of God's triunity through reason, some of them, at least, were rewarded for their austere way of life and contempt for earthly goods with an understanding of the Trinity, presumably a deeper one, by revelation. Moreover, Abelard emphasizes the availability of prophecies of the Incarnation, such as the Sibylline ones, in ancient times. By contrast, the philosopher of the Collationes is not a Platonist. His philosophical background is rather a mixture of Stoicism and Epicureanism, which stands outside this story of partial revelation. And in any case, he's happened to abandon his authorities and just follow a line of argument. Now, it's not that the philosopher is in fact presented as being ignorant of Christian revelation. On the contrary, Abelard makes him something of a connoisseur of both Jewish and Christian learning. But it's as something he regards in the dialogue as yours, as the Jews or the Christians, not his own. He philosophizes on the basis of reason and a tradition of reasoning alone. What then does the philosopher achieve through his reasoning? Well, the answer, I suggest, and it's a surprising answer, given the author who created him, has to be very little. In the first dialogue, He succeeds in rejecting the Jews' arguments for the superiority of the old law to natural law, but not his initial justification for Jews, given their vividly evoked circumstances, to hold on to their religion. In the second dialogue with the Christian, the provisional position about the highest good for humans that he reaches after repeatedly modifying his initial stance to meet his interlocutor's objection is in the end rejected in favour of a view centred on our love for God, which is quite unanticipated by him. By the end of this discussion, his role has become limited to introducing the different stages in the Christian's exposition. He has become a mere stooge. The philosopher's most solid contribution might seem to be the lengthy exposition he gives of the virtues, a topic that Abelard accepts Christians have taken over from the pagan philosophers. Yet comparison between his presentation and Abelard's own elsewhere suggests that in some cases he has been given views which his author, Abelard, rejects, such as the insistence on exact retribution rather than allowing through clemency for less punishment than is due, and the condemnation of any sort of submission of the mind to sorrow. And the philosopher is even more clearly distanced from Abelard's own views when he is made to discuss positive justice. Through the philosopher, Abelard makes a considerable innovation because he gives for the first time the distinction between natural and positive law its now familiar sense. Natural law is the same everywhere, whereas positive law is laid down by authority or through custom and applies to certain people at certain times. When the philosopher criticizes the popes and church councils for issuing decrees that go against natural law, and sorry, I should point out these on your handouts, handout A and handout B. So when he does this, Abelard is clearly using him as a detached, rational observer to criticize what he himself regards as an abuse. A few moments before, however, when the philosopher puts together circumcision for the Jews and baptism for you as commandments of positive law, he's allowed himself to fall into a trap. As a detached, rational observer, it does indeed appear to him that circumcision and baptism are on the same footing. One, a commandment binding on the Jews, the other, binding on Christians. But as Abelard and his readers would know, after the coming of Christ, baptism is needed by everyone, not just by the members of some particular group. Unlikely as such an implicit conclusion may seem, coming from Abelard, philosophizing from nowhere takes you nowhere. The eponymous hero of Ibn Tufayl's philosophical novel, Hay Ibn Yaqzan, elaborates his philosophy from nowhere even more literally than Abelard's philosopher. Indeed, on one account, Hay is himself from nowhere, spontaneously generated without father or mother. He grows up alone on an island, suckled by a doe. Hai's quest to understand what has happened when she dies leads him on a train of scientific and philosophical discovery. He eventually follows through a path of Avicennian reasoning that leads him to an intellectual grasp of the existence of the necessary being and beyond it, to the mystical experience, the very tasting of God. But after some years, Hai's communing with God is interrupted by a visitor, Absal, a pious Muslim wanting to escape the worldly way the religion is practiced in his own neighbouring island. Once Hai has learned to communicate in language, he's able to tell Absal about his intellectual discoveries. And I now read the passage, which is C on your handout. Hearing Hai's description of the beings which are divorced from the sense world and conscious of the truth, glory be to him, his description of truth himself by all his beautiful attributes, and his description, as best he could, of the joys of those who reach him and the agonies of those veiled from him, Absal had no doubt that all the traditions in his revealed lore about God, the powerful and great, and his angels, and his books, and his messengers, and the day of judgment, and heaven and hell, are images of what Hai ibn Yaqzan had witnessed. The eyes of his heart were unclosed, his mind caught fire, the reasoning faculty and tradition were at one within him. The paths of exegesis lay open before him. There was nothing difficult in the revealed lore left that he did not understand, nothing closed which was not opened, nothing dark that was not illumined. The contrast with the relationship between Abelard's philosopher and his Christian could hardly be more pointed. Philosophizing from nowhere, without any revealed scripture, indeed without any writing or even language, has led Hai to what is best intellectually, morally, and spiritually. And Absal, for all his revealed knowledge, can only learn from him. True, Abelard presents his philosophy in dialogue, not as a self-educator. But he does elsewhere touch implicitly on autodidacticism. In his Problemata Eloisi, he considers the case of someone invincibly ignorant of Christ. Later writers would add detail to the case, making the subject someone who grows up in the forest and even, like Hai, suckled by a non-human mother. But this parallel doesn't bring Abelard's approach any closer to Ibn Tufayl's. Rather, the point Abelard is making underlines their differences. He accepts that such a person could live a virtuous life by following the morality dictated by natural reason. He also believes, as Christians must do, that this person will be damned unless he knows about Christ. Abelard resolves the tension by insisting that God would provide this virtuous person through a messenger or by internal inspiration with what he needed to know. Only then can he be saved. Contrast the position of Hai, who, when told about the particularities of Mudzim belief by Absal, prayer, fasting, pilgrimage, is willing to accept them because he believes that Muhammad is a genuine prophet sent by God, but clearly did not need to learn about them for his spiritual well-being. And so I come to my second comparison, interpreting the truth and concealing it. Interpreting texts to find hidden truths is a pervasive theme among those considered philosophers in both the Latin and Arabic worlds of the 12th century. An important point in common, since, by contrast, interpretation in this sense, as opposed to exegetical deliberation to clarify the sense of a difficult author's arguments, is a side issue for Latin and Arabic philosophers in the next two centuries. Such interpreting is central to how questions about paganism are tackled, since it provides a way to negotiate clashes between the evident meaning of revealed texts and philosophical ones. But there is a striking contrast between the two traditions over how interpretation is used to negotiate these differences. It can be summarized over neatly thus. The Arabic philosophers, Muslim and Jewish, use interpretation on their sacred texts to show that their hidden meaning accords with or presents Aristotelian philosophy. The Latin philosophers use interpretation on philosophical texts to show that their hidden meaning accords with or presents Christian doctrine. In his decisive treatise, Averroes presents the Arabic approach very clearly. Any text from the Quran might either be irrelevant to, or accord with, or contradict the conclusion of a demonstration, that's to say, of a syllogistic argument with necessary premises in line with Aristotle's specifications in the Posterior Analytics. In the first two cases, there's no problem. In the third, if you look at passage D in the handout, an interpretation has to be pursued. The passage is understood figuratively in such a way that it no longer contradicts the conclusion that has been demonstrated. Averroes was indeed perhaps the most devoted Aristotelian in the whole Arabic tradition, but this rule for interpretation had been endorsed the century before by Al-Ghazali, a thinker who had, very obviously, many reservations about the Aristotelian tradition. A similar approach to interpretation is evident in the passage already quoted from Ibn Tufayl. Absal understands the Quran properly only when he has been told the conclusions of High's purely philosophical reasoning and sees that they are what the letter of the revealed text states in images. Moses Maimonides, who grew up and was educated in the same Andalusian culture as Ibn Tufayl and Averroes, has a very similar approach to interpretation. The opening portion of his Guide of the Perplexed is devoted to showing how the Torah must be interpreted where it represents God corporeally. And whatever Maimonides' real view is about the eternity of the world, he makes it clear beyond question that the text of Genesis can't settle the question in favour of a beginning, precisely because the obvious meaning of any of its statements is open to interpretation. And that's even here where the best arguments against a beginning fall short, he believes, of being demonstrations. For the Latin approach, by contrast, consider the interpretation of Plato's discussion of the world soul, as presented by Plato himself in the Timaeus, by Macrobius and Boethius. According to Abelard's mature view of the question, E in the handout, it's clear that what the philosophers say about the world soul should be understood in a figurative way, per involucrum. Otherwise, we'd have to consider Plato, the greatest of the philosophers, as the greatest of fools. For what could be more ridiculous than for the whole world to be considered as a single rational animal unless it were said figuratively? At much the same time, William of Conches took the same approach to this particular problem, although he gradually withdrew from it and abandoned it. His usual approach, however, and one he maintains throughout his work, is equally concerned with interpreting philosophical texts to fit Christian doctrine, but he doesn't usually try to find specifically Christian teachings in them, but rather, following a tradition that stretched back for centuries, he aims to neutralize in them any ideas apparently incompatible with the faith. Now, as I said, the comparison I've just made is too neat. So, for instance, in the preface to his Wisdom of Illumination, Sohrawardi, Averroes' contemporary in the East, mentions Hermes, Plato, Empedocles, and indeed some ancient Persian philosophers as sages who already knew of the wisdom he is going to teach. So it's a bit, perhaps, like some things you'll find in, say, Abelard or William of Conches. But Sohrawardi gives no examples of how to interpret them in this way, and he's citing them as forerunners of his religiously oriented philosophy rather than, as Abelard explicitly presented Hermes, Trismegistus, and Plato, as followers of the true religion long before it was publicly revealed and preached. On the other side, Latin authors sometimes read a scientific account of the origins of the world, informed by ancient philosophy, into the opening of Genesis. A famous example is the Tractatus de Sextierum Operibus, one of the few works attributed to Thierry of Chartres, which he did in all probability write himself. But, giving you this in handout G, Thierry doesn't present this interpretation as the discovery of hidden secrets. On the contrary, it is, in his view, a literal reading of the text. The opening of Genesis has been seen since the time of Basil and Augustine as capable of being filled out rather than interpreted to provide a scientific account. The hidden meanings of the Bible were rather the intrinsically Christian, allegorical and moral ones, the exposition of which Thierry decides to eschew. Where meanings are hidden, there's a further question to ask. Hidden from whom? With regard to the philosophical Aristotelian meanings concealed by the images of the Quran, The distinctive answer in the Arabic tradition, which goes back at least to Al-Farabi in the 10th century, is an elitist one. Only those intellectually endowed, highly intelligent people able to engage in Aristotelian demonstration ought to interpret in this way. This idea is central to the decisive treatise. And Averroes even rejects the compromise answer Al-Ghazali had given, which allowed those incapable of demonstration, as set out in the posterior analytics, to reason about the Quran and its doctrine using dialectical syllogisms of the sort used in Aristotle's Topics. The ending of the story of Hai shows that Ibn Tufayl, too, strongly supported this approach. Hai cannot understand why, as Absar tells him, most Muslims understand only the images transmitted by a literal reading of the Quran. So he persuades Absar to accompany him to his native island while he attempts to convert its inhabitants to his spiritual understanding of Islam. But hardly has he begun than he realizes that he's confusing the people rather than enlightening them, doing more harm than good. So, leaving them to their religion of customary practices and images, the two men return to their isolated island and their intellectual contemplation of the deity. Maimonides followed the same line of thought. He believed that the text of Genesis conceals as its true meaning physics, that the text of the opening of Genesis conceals as its true meaning physics, understood in an Aristotelian way, and the account of the chariot in Ezekiel, metaphysics. The understanding of these secret meanings was a matter of strictly oral law to be passed down only by word of mouth from teacher to a handful of chosen disciples. As often with Maimonides, however, he complicates a widely held position here in two ways. First, he does in fact reveal in writing what tradition held should be hidden. Second, Maimonides explains that he has used various devices of concealment to shut off the true meaning of his guide from those not fitted to understand it, a claim that has kept his own interpreters busy for over 700 years. Now, this type of elitism seems to be without parallels in the Latin Christian tradition. There, where a contrast is made between the intellectually adept maiores and the mass of simple people, the minores, it relates the breadth and distinctness of their grasp of the tenets of revealed doctrine. Yet there is an exception to this disparity, and that's to be found in the 12th century. The Arabic philosophical idea about concealment and elitism probably goes back in part to late ancient sources. Two late ancient Latin writers influenced by this way of thinking were Macrobius, as noted by Abelard, if you see F in the handout, and Boethius. Boethius professes the apparent wish to conceal his philosophical discussion of the Trinity from everyone except for its dedicatee. That's H on the handout. And his 12th century commentator, Gilbert of Poitiers, follows him with this, in this idea of concealment, and takes it far more seriously in practice than Boethius did. And in fact, by good fortune, in Luisa Valente's paper, you've already seen and discussed a long passage from Gilbert in this sense, putting forward this sort of idea of intellectual elitism and protecting secrets from the few. In ING, my handout, I've just given you a rather briefer discussion. So Gilbert not only uses this idea of concealment to justify a far from obvious reading of many of Boethius' arguments and positions, it also shapes Gilbert's own style in these commentaries, a style which is deliberately crafted to repel or mislead the reader unable to follow through the intricacies of his way of thought. Now, I'm very conscious that this topic and all the other ones that I've touched on could and should be developed far more, but it's time for me to draw some conclusions quickly and then finish. And I want to draw my conclusions on three levels. First, about the theme that I've been considering, the problem of paganism. Second, about how Latin and Arabic philosophy compare in the 12th century. And third, about the making of such comparisons. The conclusion I suggest on the first level is a negative one. When I wrote about the problem of paganism, I restricted myself to Latin Christian philosophy, but I expected that a same or a similar problem would be found in Arabic philosophy, Muslim and Jewish. I expected significant differences, especially with regard to discussion of salvation and virtue, but I thought the questions and difficulties would be closely shared with regard to pagan wisdom. This look this afternoon at two themes linked to pagan philosophy across the three traditions suggests otherwise. On the second level, the example I mentioned last of all, Gilbert of Poitiers' esotericism, bears out the point I made at the beginning about the value of looking not at the influence of Arabic on Latin philosophy, but at the two as parallel traditions or sub-traditions. Gilbert's thought moves in the same direction as his Arabic contemporaries because of their common heritage, whereas this aspect of Islamic and Jewish thinking is absent from the Arabic-influenced thought of the 13th and 14th century universities. And, as I've mentioned already, the centrality of interpretation as a concern for philosophers is shared by the largely independent Arabic and Latin traditions of the 12th century, but not by 13th century thinking, 13th century Latin thinking. For the most part, however, I've been pointing to the divergences between the Latin and the Arabic material from the 12th century. But I don't think the differences I've noticed support the commonly held view that the two sub-traditions cannot be fruitfully compared until the 13th century, when most of Aristotle's works became widely available in the Latin world. True, some of the differences between Latin and Arabic approaches to interpretation may have arisen because the posterior analytics was available early in the Latin tradition and left its philosophers deeply impressed by the idea and the ideal of demonstration. But the study of the posterior analytics in the 13th century Latin world, when it became available, although enormously important for how the organization and aims of university disciplines were conceived, had little effect on ways of interpretation. And the most important differences which have emerged seem to have been the result of the different restrictions and demands imposed by Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And in special, by the difference between the Christian conception of history, which could accommodate ancient wisdom only by fitting it to its own terms, and the more flexible Islamic and Jewish conceptions. And if you feel that this conclusion or these conclusions on the second level are interesting, even if you disagree with them, then I think that I've given some support to a conclusion on the third level, that this type of comparative history of philosophy, although it's rarely done, is something worthwhile attempting. Now, I'm not trying to put forward what I've done as any sort of paragon of it, but just as an example of what one might do, and I hope do much better than I've managed over the last 40 minutes. So thank you very much.